Welcome to ABA on Tap, where our goal is to find the best recipe to brew the smoothest, coldest, and best tasting ABA around. I'm Dan Lowry with Mike Rubio, and join us on our journey as we look back into the ingredients to form the best concoction of ABA on tap. In this podcast, we will talk about the history of the ABA brew, how much to consume to achieve the optimum buzz while not getting too drunk, and the recommended pairings to bring to the table. So without further ado, sit back, relax, and always analyze responsibly.
All right. And welcome to yet another episode over the lovely Zoom platform in quarantine. Maybe one of our last as we get set to return here. We'll talk about that today. I am your lovely co-host, interesting adjective, Mike Rubio, and here with my esteemed colleague and co-host, Dan Lowry. Dan, how you doing?
Good evening, brother. How you doing, man?
Doing good, man. It's been a little while for us. We've been busy. We haven't, you know, committed to a weekly schedule or anything like that with this particular podcast, but we've allowed the content to drive our recording time, meaning when we got something good and when we can make the time, which we did today, thank you, we sit down and we talk about it. And we certainly have some important things to talk about today with regard to, at least for us, professionally speaking, personally speaking, returning to in-home. For a lot of people, I don't think they've ever stopped. So we get to learn from them some of the precautions they've taken over this time as we, professionally and personally speaking, get ready to deliver services back in home. And what have we learned from telehealth, for example? And then how does that help us take further precaution for our clients so that we are truly doing the best we can with regard to medical safety practice as well as ABA practice and so on and so forth? So we could probably do much more than one podcast episode on this topic. But we'll start today. We'll give it a go. Give it a good 30, 40 minutes and see what we come up with. So first off,
guest speaker Anthony Fauci in the house today or what?
Man, if I could pull a good Fauci impersonation, I'd give it a shot. It's kind of a little bit Bronx-y, New York-y, very smart. So let's start there. The idea of face coverings. The idea that the ones we go in with will not protect from incoming particles. And like every other face covering that's been promoted socially, is meant to protect everybody else, right? To catch your droplets. I can think of a lot of clients that aren't going to be okay with complying with wearing a face covering. Let's just start with that simple premise there. And Mr. Lowry.
that's going to be interesting. My girlfriend teaches special ed, and that's going to be interesting for her mild severe demographic as well, as they look at reopening schools as well, which relates obviously to ABA as to how that demographic is addressed as well. So yeah, I think that's very pertinent. I really like what you said, though. You opened up my eyes maybe a few weeks ago, that something I never even thought about with our younger kids, and the fact that some of the masks that we wear might be defeating as we try to present oral models and things like that. So let me pass it back to you. I never even thought about that. I was like, okay, cool, we'll just use a mask. But that might be 60-70% of the programs that we run out the window if we wear a mask. So,
well, it means that we certainly rule ourselves out as a visual model for oral motor movement. Absolutely. And it, you know, from a practical perspective, it means me working alongside our technicians and saying, how many of you are comfortable with the idea of a face shield that would still allow you to to lend that visual model? But in that sense, I guess the client now is more compromised with regard to your droplets, and you're certainly much more open with regard to theirs, knowing that going in with a face covering, it's not an N95, so you're not protected. That's just the way it is. But a face covering is going to give you that 2%, you know, minimal protection over nothing or over just a face shield. I'm speculating there, certainly not using hard data. But I would imagine the cloth is better than just open air. Yeah, I mean, so many things to consider. Again, now that said, that could be, you know, a very, very defeating premise. But what have we learned during telehealth, which is, hey, mom and dad, instructional control staying with you guys, that seems to be working really well. So now let me tell you what to do, and you make sure they're watching your mouth, which from a developmental perspective, for a two-year-old, you know, unless you've got some super kicking, fully accredited preschool, they're still getting most of these cues from mom and dad anyway. So we would be really typifying our instruction in that sense if we start providing the treatment to the parent, even though they don't have the diagnosis, which is a topic we've talked about here before in terms of ABA and how interesting it is medically speaking. The child, often the younger client, younger patient, if you will, has the diagnostic, but really the whole community, the whole family environment, if we're going to be effective, has to receive the treatment. So it really, you know, harkens us or behooves us to put our money where our mouth is with regard to that now, and how are we going to use that new knowledge of empowering parents during this time where we might still have to be limited. So I'll pass that along to you, see if you have any thoughts from that little blunderbuss and stream of consciousness I just lent.
Yeah, no, I've always said from day one that I think ABA should be a predominantly parent training model. And the fact that, you know, it's common that a kid get 40 hours a week of direct and 4 hours a week of parent training seems exactly inverse to me. But I know that's a conversation for another day. I have seen that a lot of the parents have been surprised by the level of rigor that has been required to run an ABA session, which has been good, too. And that I think some of them are hitting their quota. They're hitting their satiation point, I think, on running sessions, and they wanted us to be in pretty much yesterday. So we are running into that. Something that, back to the mask thing, that actually crossed my mind as you were talking, that, and I was kind of talking as well about along the same lines of, presumably there's going to be some level of recommendation or requirement that kids wear masks in school. So how important is that going to be that we start developing mask tolerance programs for kids that aren't wearing masks and things like that, and looking at whatever that new normal is and maybe deviating from some of our ABA programs to look at some of the things that are going to be necessary for kids to get into more of the mainstream or neurotypical environments. What's your opinion on that?
Yes. Yeah, I had recently... one of our colleagues, one of our esteemed colleagues, I'll just go ahead and mention her by name, Tanya Valentina, had sent out some information about social stories and preparing kids to wear masks. And the first thought on my mind was, we're going to have to take a little detour because we're going to, just like we did with telehealth, we're going to have to create the space and the rules again. And here I am also somebody who is a big proponent with a great degree of caution on tactile reinforcement, you know, especially with little guys, rubbing the head, patting the back. No, that's all out the window now. That's and again, it's not, I'm not airing a grievance or sharing a gripe about that. Not at all. It's just, it's going to have to change. We're going to have to find new ways to get kids to pay attention to people's mouths, for example, as they learn to speak. And by and large, that may not mean our mouths anymore. So again, transferring that stimulus control, that instructional control to the parents. You mentioned them, you know, discussing fatigue and being a little bit overwhelmed. And I think that's something we'll have to deal with in terms of the new normal, how much more we're asking the parents to do, knowing that we've actually seen a great deal of progress with that new model, and it makes a great deal of sense, and not to make us feel on edge about becoming obsolete or putting us at risk. It just means that You know, our RBTs have to adapt a new level of knowledge, a new level of practice, just something different, you know, kind of employing all their current skills and knowledge in a different way, funneling in a different manner. So I'm excited for what's to come. I say that with a degree of caution toward the medical risk, given my age and, you know, being male and whatnot. It's, you have to think a couple times and be like, oh, do I really want to give myself 14 days of what people are describing? Probably not. But we're going to have to face that. We're going to have to figure it out. As I say that, I'll kick one over to you, which is, working largely case management or so-called supervision and a lot of parent education, by and large, I expect to be doing this telehealth thing for a long time because I don't suspect we're going to be having a great number of people saying, sure, don't just send one of you in here, send two of you in here. And then beyond that, you know, again, so these are questions that are still to be answered for many, many of our colleagues and many practitioners. But from a behavioral perspective, as we take caution, things that we're going to have to answer.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. And that's much more along the medical model, right? Of you come, you get a service, and then it goes into like a check-in. And granted, you know, maybe not the initial assessment, things like that, but clients that have been receiving services for a while might be more apt for that check-in model. That's more along the lines of the medical model. So yeah, maybe services, both direct and supervision, are done through telehealth. I think it's been, a lot of parents have seen surprisingly good results. There've definitely been some roadblocks. I think one thing that I would like to get your two cents on, being a parent, is that the trajectory I've seen. So we're in the week, probably almost 18 now, somewhere in that range. All of April, all of May, and then probably split March and June.
Yeah.
In the beginning, parents were just kind of freaked out and unsure that we're starting telehealth, so it was kind of a crap show. And then parents really started to participate and things were good. And I think now, like I mentioned earlier, we're hitting that point where parents are ready for us to be in the house. Now, my question to you is, how do we facilitate? And number one, do you see? And number two, how do we facilitate a smooth transition to say, hey, this is what you've been doing. Let's keep doing it. Because a lot of parents are just so ready for respite to be in there and ready. Anyone who can come just deal with their kids so they can get that 2 hours of escape that they haven't gotten in 3 months is going to be so welcome. So what do you see that transition looking like?
So I think you're right. We're going to lose the direct observable participation to some degree. And the reason for that isn't just necessarily parents wanting some reprieve, which I think it's important to note that while we want 100% parent participation, we do serve that purpose. So that's okay. Sometimes we do come in and kind of help reinforce, you know, the troops and help things move forward. But just naturally by circumstance, as we set to reopen, we also have parents who were largely at home, working from home, now also getting set to reopen. So I think where we're going to want to play on a real strength of our progress during this time is in our so-called behavior support plans and what we're asking parents to do now, knowing that they can do it and that they're much more capable than maybe even we initially assessed before quarantine, and in all fairness, probably more than we tended to assess because we took on a good part of the responsibility just naturally by design. So I think we're going to want to lean on those parents for those behavior support plans and what we're asking them to do now off camera, not during those times when they're at work and maybe we're providing in-home service with all the necessary precautions along with one of the parents or maybe, you know, an older sibling or maybe, yikes, extended multi-generational family member that also lives. You know, again, how many homes, just to continue the conversation, how many homes do you go into for supervision where you've got grandparents providing childcare, mom coming in and out for work, other cousins coming in and out, really a lot of vectors that now we're becoming a part of. And, you know, as much as people have different viewpoints on the contagion, We're going to have to take the greatest degree of precaution that science is lending to us, that Dr. Fauci is lending to us, and make people feel fully comfortable. Even the ones that are like, oh, my God, come here yesterday, please. They're still going to look at us once in a while and go, hey, well, wait a minute. I heard there was an upsurge. Can you make sure that you wear this and take your shoes off and this, that, and the other? And we're just going to have to deal with that, knowing that, medically speaking, all of it might not amount to a whole lot of protection, unfortunately. But we've got to take a shot at it. Otherwise, we're not going to know. It's really so many questions to be answered. I know that I have to, in advance, admire, any of our colleagues out there, and I extend that as widely as I can, who have been actively doing this. I know we've got some people near and dear to us in Arizona, for example, who have not yet stopped throughout this entire time going into people's homes. I think we're really going to be at the forefront of medical treatment in many ways as we open things back up, because we're coming into that very direct personal contact with people. So I don't know that our work is just added a new level of importance to so many things, to how we're going to contribute to special education, to medical practice. Our clients are also going to seek and need medical treatment during this time. Many things that we haven't explored with regard to that. So, it's an exciting time, but it's very scary. It's very daunting at the same time. I think that I'm looking forward to the contributions that we might lend as a field of ABA to many other questions, not just, treating autism, but things like safety practice, precautions, things that are going to affect the general public much more. Not to mention something we won't go into right now, but much more political practice, racial tension, policing, things that maybe ABA on tap will choose to delve into here in the near future, because it does involve individual behavior. So
everything involves behavior, right? It always comes down to behavior.
We always try to parse it out, I'm thinking about a lot of our kids who are struggling with still some summer school or ongoing school attempts to teach them. And my full desire to incorporate some of that content into our sessions, for example, which, it's a fine line to walk, because I'm by no means teaching math. But if I don't help this kid feel more comfortable with his math, then he's probably not going to look at that screen anymore. And that's going to upset the parents. And now we've got this cascade of antecedents, if you will, to this undesire to run away from the Zooms, because now I'm bored, my friends aren't there, this is weird, and I don't like math to begin with, just to give a hypothetical situation. So we have to, begin to learn from that and reconsider what our content is. Again, we're not teaching math. That's the school's role. But can we help kids self-monitor their own enjoyment or practice of math? Absolutely, we can. So, there's a lot to learn. I'm excited. Again, there's a lot to learn, so it's also daunting. But here we go.
Yeah. I think one of the interesting, I can't say it's surprising, but one of the things that I found is that for some of the RBTs that feel a little bit less successful, they're saying like, oh, I can't motivate my kid, or, oh, if my kid doesn't want to participate, they're just not participating. And I think that, A, that's going to be kind of enlightening as we go back, as we've hopefully that sheds light that maybe we've forced kids to participate in things that they didn't want to participate. But on a different level, it seems like the most common reinforcer that any, I want to say, ABA practitioner uses, if they're honest with themselves, is electronics. And now we're offering more electronic reinforcers and the kids aren't motivated. So maybe it's showing how often we prompted and how often we kind of forced the square peg through the round hole, so to speak, without even really realizing it. And now that if a kid doesn't want to do session, they just turn around or they put their head down and we're not there to physically prompt them to do anything and they don't do session, which maybe should be kind of the more ABA way of doing things is, oh, well, the kid doesn't like this. Let me put on another video. Let me try this. What can I do to get this kid to look up, or individual, whatever, this individual to look up to get their engagement? Because I'm not going to be able to basically force their engagement anymore. That's been the number one kind of complaint or I guess, setback that I've been hearing from a lot of my clients. That if they don't want to participate, especially in our social groups, they're just not going to participate. And, you know, ABA is a product of the environment. And so often I feel like we want the kid to, we're going to send the kid to a breakout room, or we're going to talk to them about how they need to participate more. But the environment is us. So, you know, really highlights how we need to change what we're doing to be more motivating, not necessarily make them be more motivated by the same things that we're doing.
Oh, man.
It's my soapbox.
That's a really good one. And I could build my own box right next to you on all the things you said, because it was so rich.
Soapboxes are good for quarantine.
Yeah, they are.
It's for tough. COVID, right? It's an antiviral soapbox.
Soapboxes and soliloquies. Just talk to yourself. So it speaks back to some of the things that we've spoken about on the show, on this podcast, with regard to our own flexibility. And, you know, this is with all due respect. It's like, well, let's try what we know, which is exactly the way the experimentation should work. What do we know, and how do we apply it to a new situation like telehealth? And then how much do we force it before we realize, man, we got to change, because this is not working. Now, unfortunately, just like yelling at a kid or hitting them, once in a while it does work. So then an RBT takes that, or a professional takes that, and they run with it. And now they want to generalize that. And again, that's not incorrect as much as what can we learn about how we modify those things. And now, you know, use the other techniques that we had a hard time adapting, but I know that I've always love discussing with you things like, okay, so I'll just use some examples from my day to day. The kid wasn't engaging with us at all. We helped the parent with some school content and interpret that and ideas to do it. Kid starts engaging with us on screen with the parent help. We want the parent to be there. Kid's young enough that they shouldn't be by themselves. But they still have this knack of understanding what the school content is. So anything that's not related to, or what we call non-preferred, that's not reinforcement related, she's going to start crying and leave the screen, right? So what do we do about that? Well, we have to desensitize. Wait a minute, she's crying, but she's not leaving the screen. So how do we get mom to soothe her during that time so she now tolerates that new content? And then now to what it is now, which is, okay, you're not preferring it, and you have this wince on your face, but you're not leaving the chair. You're not crying anymore, which means you can hear more of what needs to be heard from a school content perspective. And now we can reinforce you for, you know, differentially for a new and more desired behavior. So it was a lot of shaping, much more shaping than maybe we're accustomed to doing, even though we would love to use that technology in speaking. We may not necessarily apply it in the same way, because we want to come in with our own targets and our very clear goals, and how long we wait for those to come about or a rapport to be built, you know, that's something that maybe we've learned more about during quarantine. Okay, and pardon a longer than usual pause there if it sounds awkward. We're not sure at this point. We had a little Zoom blip. Dan, I was wrapping up the idea of rapport building and shaping, and what have we learned during quarantine? How will we apply that moving forward?
That's a great question. I think, taking a good look at the rapport building. I think with shaping, I even want to take like a larger, more macro view of it, that I know we talked about in our first episode, that, you know, Lovaas, right? He started at the table and chair, and here we are 50 years later, and a lot of people are still doing table and chair. And I think we did the same exact thing with telehealth. Maybe it's just that direct or literal use of technology, that it was, okay, so we're away from the table and chair. Now we're at the computer. So what does that mean? That means the kid has to sit in front of the computer, and that's where a session's going to be. The computer is the new table and chair. So I think when you talk about shaping, I'm looking at it. We can definitely talk about how, you know, how we work to shape parents' involvement and things like that. I think this was a good conduit for that. It was almost like a blunt force. Parents have to be involved.
Agreed.
But I'm even thinking more on the lines of shaping what we do, depending on how long we have to do telehealth. I know both you and some of the other case managers have said, you know what, maybe us asking this 3-year-old kid to sit in front of a computer and be attentive and engaged is unreasonable. So let's shape it by trying to do it on a phone and walking around and things like that, kind of changing the dynamic. Yeah. That's what I think of when I think of shaping.
Whose behavior is being shaped?
Exactly. I think of that. And I think of how we can make this telehealth and how we can learn from it, too, that it doesn't always have to be, you know, this one way, this one clear SD, clear sit down, clear focus on something. Like, that's not that's one way that kids learn. That's not the only way that kids learn.
Well, it's the idea. I mean, and for me, it's just based on my background and how I came about into ABA, very circuitous route, very unplanned and happenstance. I'm glad I'm here. But the idea that from the very beginning of my ABA days and say, okay, so I come in and I have to run this program first because this is the way the data book is set up. And this is, but what if the kid doesn't want to do this one? You know, with this idea of behavioral momentum, can't I get them to do this one first and then go? No, because this is the way it's, you know, it's like, and I got to do 10 trials. Why? Because you can't divide by any other number. I mean, oh, I'm sorry. Whoopsie. I'm sorry. That was a little bit facetious, but you get my point.
No, Mike, it's because the trial by trial sheet has 10 boxes.
Right. Well, lab to the living room. Again, this idea of standardization versus, from a very human perspective, playing the margin of error. So, yeah, you know, you've seen my efforts on building joint attention and really getting technicians to focus on that as a behavior that we can record or observe. Use whatever works and make sure you're using sights and sounds and then their eye contact as a response as well as their pointing. And then maybe you're going to get them to respond to their name as a singular target, not this macro overall arching, if you don't do this now, you know, 8 out of 10 times over some consecutive streak, you're clearly, you know, severely autistic or something. I'm being facetious, but you get my point. It's like, man, we really worked that ad nauseum. Are you sure that's the one skill response to name? Or is there a bigger umbrella that we should be dealing with, like joint attention, ta-da, response to sounds, whoa, orientation of gaze to sounds, hey, all other behaviors that we maybe have mistaken for targets, like colors or response to name, for example, you know. Again, not that it was wrong, but maybe not sorted out as well as we could have. But of course not, because it was a direct transfer of technology. And dear people like Ivor Lovas expected us to expand the technology, not just replicate and get stuck in it.
Yeah, I think it just highlights our kind of innate, our muscle memory is to go to that authoritarian approach. I feel like in ABA, that very authoritarian and the almost deficit model of, you have a deficit, so you need to sit across from me and you need to listen to me because I'm going to teach you and there's one way to teach you. And I'm saying this, I know I sound extreme. I'm saying this from a company that I feel like is one of the most progressive and least table oriented companies that I'm aware of. And I still see some of that authoritarian, that sit down in front of me kind of, we're going to run through trials. Like you said, the 10 trials, so we can hit all those trials, ABA. So yeah, that's just what kind of came to my head when you said shaping. And the other thing that kind of came to my head too is, you know, people saying like, oh, the kid won't pay attention. They keep wanting to leave. Well, why is that a problem? See where they go. Like, what? Why do they have to stay right there for the whole hour? Why are they incumbent to listen to all that we say and do exactly what we say when we say to do it? You know, why can't they leave and go play and we can follow them and make what they're doing a little bit more interesting? So that's just, you know, what comes to my head when we talk about these things and what I'm going to try to take back from the coronavirus. And I kind of wrapping this topic up is lessons from the coronavirus is I want you guys, when we're back in person, is to pretend we're on the video screen and you're not going to be able to make that kid do what you want because, and you know, we'll talk about it in a later podcast as we talk about potentially policing and how often potentially police resort to the force because they can use it, where while it might not be the best option, but it's one that they can use and is readily available. I feel like sometimes in ABA we do that. I'm not saying we touch our kids, you know, but because we can prompt them or we can block them or we can withhold things from them. Like, it's very, you know, it's an easy thing to do. So as we go back into the field, pretend that your kid is on the other side of a video screen and you can't make him do something. Now, how are you going to incent him to do it rather than make him do it?
Yeah. And get the parent to do the same and get the parent to do the same and take your model and think about it as, you know, you make so many good points. That difference, that slight difference between authoritarian and authoritative. Go ahead. You had one more.
Yeah, you actually brought up, I'm sorry, I do just want to interrupt because you brought up make the parents do the same. I agree so wholeheartedly with that. I was doing a parent group last week and the parent was saying that their kid's a teenager, hit the mom for the first time in a while. He used to do it a lot, but he did it again, some spontaneous recovery-ish. And the parent was saying, well, he needs to know that he can't do that. And I was like, no, he can do that. He can do a lot of things. He can cuss. He can do it. They're like, no, he can't.
In fact, well, I guess he did do it.
That's why he did it. Our job isn't to make it so somebody can't do it. It's to figure out an incentive to make them not want to do it. And I feel that vocabulary is really, really powerful in how we word things. So I think, like you just said, I just wanted to expand on that. Saying, you know, oh, they can't do it. Not really accurate.
I mean, that's a really, really strong point in terms of what have we learned and how are we going to transfer this and how is it going to fit right into the medical safety and the new practices we're going to have to adopt as, you know, we learn more about contagion and how not to be a part of it. And you make really good points in terms of the idea of policing. And I know that's a word I use cautiously right now and that we are certainly going to traipse into from a more socio-political perspective. But it applies here in the very same light, and I want to make that point, from the idea of being authoritarian or being authoritative. There are few situations in this, you know, life, I would say, where a parent needs to take what I like to say a hard no. And a lot of times we want to enforce a hard no when it's not necessary. So, hey, you're 3 years old, you're 4 years old, you're unaware, you're running into the middle of the street. I don't care what argument or tantrum you throw, I'm not going to give in to that. Okay, so that's a hard no. Let's fast forward a few years, your teacher's asking you to write your spelling words 3 times each as practice. You hate writing from a mechanics, from a fine motor perspective, and you suck at spelling. So how are we going to get them to write? Well, you have to write it. Well, you have to write it. No. What if they look at the sheet, they spell it out loud while you write it in highlighter, and then they trace over it? They've actually encoded the word 2 times. They spelled it out loud, and they've traced it. And maybe they've watched you spell it. And maybe you spell it back to them after they spelled it. Now there's a 3rd time they've had to encode every word. That's the entire reason the teacher asked them to do that. But as parents, we might also get stuck into an authoritarian perspective and not consider all these other options that we have available to us and just getting our kids to encode. In all fairness, we're trained in this. It's easy for us to think about this. And maybe it's not so easy for parents, which is what, you know, one of the functions we may serve, hopefully, to be a helpful resource. But the idea is more, don't get stuck. Don't get stuck in the idea of, I said jump, and I told you how high. And if you don't do it now to that exact height, now you failed, and I'm not going to give you anything to promote any approximation toward that greater goal. I'm just going to go ahead and say, nope, X, nope, minus. Oh, are we guilty of that? Maybe. Maybe a little too black or white, not enough differential reinforcement, not enough gray that we're sort of building up on from a much more human perspective, you know, again. I'm on my soapbox now. But you get the point. What have we learned? What have we learned? Mr. Lowry,
I do get the point.
It's going to be a good time for us to start bringing it together here for our audience here as we hit the 40-minute mark. But we're good. Let's take a chance to try to wrap it all up into something nice.
I do get your point. And I think just wrapping it up, so things we learned from the COVID is that, number one, parents can participate. Number two, parents can be the primary treatment modality, and it is effective.
I like that.
Yet frustrating for a lot of parents. We also learned that maybe we prompt and didn't realize how authoritarian we were. And I guess we realized that it's going to be important that kids can see our faces and that maybe we use some face shields instead of face masks. And we work on ways of promoting behaviors with increased distance and reduced physical prompting and things like that. So that's what I took from it. I'll pass it to you if you want to add any additional COVID-19 getting back into the house tips.
No, I mean, I think you nailed it all. And I would just encourage us to not put away, by any means, be like, oh, back to normal now where they're physically, knowing that there's a very hybrid model awaiting us no matter what. So let's continue to expand our knowledge of how to deliver this from a telehealth perspective. Let's continue what I consider to be full parent empowerment. You know, thinking of this like a dental procedure, if your kid is young enough and they're getting a root canal, yikes, this may be a bad example, but you're not going to leave the dentist there by themselves. You're going to want to be in there, you know? And that's kind of what we're saying now. Hey, you kind of want to be in here because, in fact, you're kind of like the dentist in this case. Once we leave, we need you to be running these procedures. So that's the only thing I would add to your very full list is let's just remember that this is now a hybrid model. That new normal doesn't mean back to what it was before mid-March. It now means a hybrid. It means a little bit of both with one last thing. A whole bunch of social skills now redefined. Are you looking at my mouth? Am I uncovering my mouth for a second, covering it back up? Am I lending you more gestures? More importantly, am I putting it back to your parents to make sure you're looking at their mouths because now I got to keep my mouth covered? How safe are you along with testing? Do I wear a face shield? You know, so on and so forth. So many variables. I do admire our colleagues in our field for staying on top of this, especially those of us who, you know, like me, like you, haven't had the luxury of telehealth this entire time. We are very grateful for that and looking forward to learning, you know, from the rest of our colleagues how to stay safe. So please do provide feedback on Facebook, Buzzsprout, any of the avenues that we provided. Our Facebook page gives a phone number and email address. Please do give us your feedback, send your questions. We want to start proliferating more important information to that nice core of you listeners that has been listening. Thank you so much.
Cheers.
Cheers. You guys stay safe out there. We'll come right back at you with something very soon. Bye-bye.